Last Sunday morning, we stood out in the middle of the Sinai desert and marveled at the magnificent tent of God called the Tabernacle. And we learned that that ancient building project in many ways parallels building projects for modern times as well. We learned about the various stages that those people went through, from preparation to design to trouble, and from the troubles to the fundraising to contractors and construction and completion, and finally, the blessing of God. Now this morning, we move a long way. We move out of the Sinai desert all the way to the city of Jerusalem. We move nearly 500 years in time through history to the year 960 BC. We visit the time of Solomon, in that time of real opulence, the peak of the dynasty of David and Solomon, the peak of the wealth and the power of the nation of Israel. And then we stand before one of the wonders of the ancient world, the temple, the magnificent temple to Jehovah God, built under the leadership of King Solomon. That temple, in its statistics, is virtually mind-boggling. It was not large. In fact, the basic building was not even as large as the tabernacle. It had, in addition to that main building, porticos and patios and verandas and things like that, although the whole size of the building wouldn't be anywhere near the magnitude of this church building that we're in this morning. The basic structure, though, was only 90 feet by 30 feet, 2,700 square feet in area. By comparison, this auditorium is 7,700 square feet in area, meaning that that basic temple would have fit three times over in the room in which we are worshiping this morning. But while the building may have been small in size, it was astronomically expensive in cost. The price of the gold alone, by today's standards, exceeded $1 billion. And for those of you that have either calculators or quick pens and pencils on registration cards, that comes to a square footage cost in excess of $333,000. That means if you had an area that's 1 foot by 3 feet, it would cost $1 million to construct that. The time for construction, it was also long. It took 7.5 years to build that temple. Part of the reason for it was they had to go great distances to get the very special wood. They had to go to great lengths in order to construct that which they built. And almost all of the construction, except for the assembly, was done off-site. They would carve the huge stones at quarries and bring those limestones up to Jerusalem, to the hill where the temple was built. In fact, the record says that not once was there ever the sound of a hammer or any other tool during the entire 7.5 years of construction. Now, there may not have been the sound of tool, but there certainly must have been the sounds of people, because the crew to construct it included 183,300 workers. 3,300 of them were supervisors. 180,000 of them were laborers. Impressive facts? Yeah, they sure are. But not really what's most important. Not what's most important at all. In fact, as you read through the Old Testament record in 1 Kings and the repeat of it in 1 and 2 Chronicles, you can't help but be impressed that God was about something far more significant than the construction of a building. And that more significant task of God was the teaching of lessons to his people. As we transfer that to our time, we make all kinds of comparisons. Today, we're not Jews, we're Christians. The temple isn't on a hill in Jerusalem. Our bodies are the temples of the Holy Spirit. The time, it's not 1,000 years before Christ, it's almost 2,000 years after Christ. And so to us, the ancient temple of Jerusalem means relatively little. But the lessons, oh, the lessons, they transcend ethnic origin and geographic location and time fix. The lessons are as much for us today as they were for the ancient Israelites 3,000 years ago. So what we're about this morning, as part of our continuing series on Old Testament building projects through January, is to learn the lessons. They're valuable, they're invaluable for us to understand today. There are at least six of them that appear in 1 and 2 Chronicles, the first of which that we want to take a look at this morning is the great lesson about godly senior leaders. Godly senior leaders who give a vision for the future of God's people. It all began in 1 Chronicles 28:2 with the dream of David the king, a royal dream. To put it in historic perspective and understand personally what was happening, we need to know that David was 70 years old, an elderly man by those ancient standards, and technically a senior citizen or a senior adult even in 1982. He had been king for 40 years, 40 relatively tumultuous years, years in which the kingdom had been divided, there had been civil war, there had been wars of oppression from the outside, there had been dissent and difficulty in the inside. They were not easy years for David, but they were years in which he walked with God and learned a great deal from him and about him. Now, at this point in the history of that great king of Israel, he was about to die, and he had a dream, one thing that he wanted to do. He shared with his people in 1 Chronicles 28:2, saying, "Hear me, my brethren and my people." The old man says, "I had it in my heart to build a house of rest for the ark of the covenant of the Lord and for the footstool of our God, and I made preparations for building." One dream, more than the people remembering the magnificent psalms that he wrote, more than people remembering that he unified the kingdom and made it really a kingdom for the first time, more than remembering even the close relationship that he had with God. What he wanted was that his dream be fulfilled, that he build a temple to Jehovah, God of Israel. And God's answer to the dream, an emphatic and simple and direct divine no. 1 Chronicles 28:3 records from David's lips, "But God said to me, 'You may not build a house for my name, for you are a warrior and have shed blood.'" How must David have been tempted to react? Wasn't God the one who had called him to battle? Wasn't God the one who had challenged him to kill Goliath and to fight against the Philistines? Wasn't he a man who had shed blood and been a man of war because God had told him to shed blood and be a man of war? Must he not have been tempted to bitterness that his dreams would not come true? Must he not have been tempted to resentment? Resentment that a younger generation that had not been through the wars and through the battles and the difficulties would get to fulfill his dream? I mean, it might have been easier to live with if God had just said there won't be a temple. But to say that he couldn't do it and only a few years later someone else could do it. Must he not have been tempted to anger? Anger at being left out on the one project that he wanted to be included in? Must he not have been tempted to withhold his support from such a project, thinking if they're going to do it, let them do it. But if I can't be part of it, then I'm not going to support it. I think those temptations must have been very real in David's life. But instead of yielding to those temptations, he responded favorably to God and yielded to the Lord by providing magnificent spiritual leadership, godly leadership, to his people Israel. It shows up in various forms in 1 Chronicles 28. It begins with advice. Advice in 1 Chronicles 28:9 and 10 that is really great advice for every generation. He says to Solomon his son, "And you, Solomon my son, know the God of your father and serve him with a whole heart and with a willing mind. For the Lord searches all hearts and understands every plan and thought. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will cast you off forever. Take heed now, for the Lord has chosen you to build a house for the sanctuary. Be strong and do it." Do you notice what his advice was? Not first of all to build a building, but first of all to seek God and to walk with him and to be found by him. Magnificent advice that even the wise young man Solomon needed to hear from his godly father who had long walked with the Lord. To advice, David added plans. The plans are spelled out, and I'll not read the text. From verses 11 to 19 of 1 Chronicles 28, we're told that then David gave Solomon his son the plan, so that the vision of what he wanted accomplished, that which he had sketched out and that which he had foreseen, that which he had hoped for, he turned over to Solomon into the next generation. What a marvelous principle for us, that every generation needs godly elderly leaders like David who look more to God's future than to their own past. You see, one of the inevitable things that happens as any of us grow older is that we tend to be full of the past, and that becomes the focus of our sight. But that wasn't true for David. His eyes were far more in the future than even the great past that had gone before. To advice and plans, this godly leader added tremendous encouragement. In verse 20, we read that then David said to Solomon, his son, "Be strong and of good courage and do it. Fear not." Apparently, he thought that Solomon would be afraid. "Be not dismayed," because apparently he thought that Solomon would be discouraged. "Fear not, be not dismayed, for the Lord God, even my God, is with you. He will not fail you or forsake you until all the work for the service of the house of the Lord is finished." I can't help but imagine how Solomon must have handled those words. Because inevitably, in any project of the magnitude that Solomon and the people of Israel undertook, there must have been all kinds of fears and discouragements. There must have been times when the workers didn't do the job as they should and where money was going to run short, and there was questions that maybe they should have been satisfied with the old tabernacle, or David had misled them, or they should have done it when David was alive, or all kinds of things. And I suspect that Solomon must have had his days too, when he went out into the countryside and would hide away under some olive tree and reflect on the words of encouragement that had come from his father. David, the man who knew God. David, who had said, "My son, my son, my son, don't be afraid. Don't be discouraged. God will not leave you. God will not forsake you. God will see your project through to completion." There must have been 1,000 times when Solomon, in gratitude, praised the Lord for that godly advice that had come from his elderly father, David. To advice and plans and encouragement, David added in his godly leadership even personal sacrifice. In 1 Chronicles 29:2, David says, "I have provided for the house of my God so far as I was able." He gave everything he was able to give. Now keep in mind, David never saw that temple. He died before it was even started, much less finished. It was a project that he was never to participate in, and yet he gave everything he was able to give. According to verse 3, he even gave his private treasures. And if you were to skip back to chapter 22, verse 14, you'd record the more personal words when he says, "With great pains I have provided for the house of the Lord." David, the godly king, gave until it hurt, until it was a painful experience for him to do. But he set an example so that all the rest of the people of Israel, as recorded in verses 6 through 9, joined in sacrificial giving so that God's project could be pulled off. Advice, plans, encouragement, sacrifice. But I think the fifth element of his godly leadership is the most significant of them all, and that's the support that he gave. He stood behind his son, he stood behind the leaders of Israel, he stood behind the project. And the old father stood before the nation of Israel and spoke about his son Solomon. Must have been an emotional time. I would think it would be for any father as he would publicly speak to and about his son. David says, "Solomon, my son, whom alone God has chosen, is young and inexperienced, and the work is great." Solomon was wise, the wisest man who ever lived, but he was young. Solomon was wise, but he was inexperienced. Solomon was wise, but the work was indeed great. David, in his experience in life, offered his public support behind young Solomon. David, with all of his years of walking with God, offered his support and garnered the support of the entire nation of Israel for Solomon, who was inexperienced. David, who had been through great undertakings for God and to whom God had always been faithful, called upon the support of his people for Solomon in the building of the temple when the work was great. Quite a man, wasn't he? What a marvelous act, recognizing Solomon's weaknesses and claiming God's strengths, turning potential failure into probable success. Now, what does all that have to do with us? How does that come down to Wooddale? Well, let me speak, if I may, plainly, candidly. Especially, let me speak plainly and candidly to those from Wooddale who are either long experienced in number of years or perhaps in the number of years here associated with this church family. God has richly blessed this church, for almost four decades with godly leadership, with men and women who offered advice and plans and encouragement, who sacrificed greatly and supported all kinds of things for God's cause. But I would say, in all the history of this church, if ever there was a need for that kind of godly senior leadership, it's now. If ever before there was a time when we need a King David, lots of King's Davids, it's in 1982. In a sense, the senior leaders of this church have been challenged with the same challenge that was given to David, an opportunity to be tempted to all kinds of other negative ways, or to say, by God's grace, we will do precisely what David did. We will give vision for the future. I'll tell you what my honest prayer is. My honest prayer is that for this church, those senior leaders will give a vision for the future that includes advice, godly advice. Godly advice on how many of us who are young and inexperienced like Solomon can walk 100% with Jesus Christ. My prayer is that these senior leaders of this church will give to us your plans, your dreams, your visions. Visions and plans and dreams that may not be fulfilled even in your generation, but which are visions and plans and dreams far more from God than from yourself. That you'll give to us your encouragement, that when there is difficulty and when there is fear and when there are problems, your words will echo in our minds, that there is an example that has been set before us, an encouragement that has been given that will outweigh any discouragement that ever the enemy or circumstances can provide. My prayer is that you'll show us your sacrifice. Many of us have never learned to trust God as we should, have never sacrificed as you have sacrificed, have never learned to give until there is pain. And so my prayer is that you'll set for us an example, that you'll show us the way. My prayer is that you will give support. Like Solomon 1,000 years before Christ, we are young and inexperienced, and we need Davids like you who will stand with us and for us and attempt great things together for God. My prayer is that you will say yes to the question, will you be our Davids? Will you be the godly senior leaders of 1982 who will give to this church, as David gave then to Israel, a vision for the future? The lesson? The lesson is that godly senior leaders give a great vision for the future. Well, we have a lot more lessons we want to learn this morning. Let's press on to a second one. That second lesson is that God values obedience over buildings. God's highest priority is the way we obey. Back in 1 Kings chapter 6, verses 11 to 13, you don't need to turn there, but just listen to the words that were spoken to Solomon by the Lord. The Lord said to him, concerning this house which you are building, okay? Concerning this house which you're building. But then he doesn't talk much at all about the construction aspects of it. He says instead, if you will walk in my statutes and obey my ordinances and keep my commandments and walk in them, then will I establish my word with you, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. Do you see what God was concerned about? Not primarily concerned about a construction project, but primarily concerned that his people obey and walk with him. That's so profound and so simple at the same time. When only we grasp that, we see life from God's perspective. And that's precisely what we need. We need God's perspective. It's demonstrated in practically every area of life. Most of us tend to think of job as something that you do, and that's what's important. It's important the job that you have. In fact, we define people that way. We say, who do you work for, or where do you work, or what is your job? God's major concern is not our job. God's major concern is the work we do on the job. It's the way we do it. We, from our perspective, say that the most important thing is who you're married to. The Bible says relatively little about the selection of a maiden who we're married to, but says a great deal about the way we live within the marriage that God gives to us. He's more concerned about the way we do it than even the person to whom we are married. The same thing goes for a building project or a building undertaking. As far as God's concerned, the greatest issue of all is not whether this church is here in a building or in Eden Prairie in a building, whether it's this building or some other building. What God is most concerned about is the way we obey Him and walk with Him and live with Him during the process. The same projects can be undertaken from totally different perspectives. It's possible for a church to build a building and do it with pride rather than humility. It's possible for a church to build a building with dissent rather than with unity. It's possible for a church to build a building depending upon its own resources rather than depending upon the resources of God. The lesson, the valuable lesson that we need to learn is that God values obedience most of all, far more than the projects to which He calls us. And so we need to make every effort to live lives pleasing to Him amidst the undertaking that we embark upon for Him. Lesson number three is that good theology generates joyous giving. It's really summed up in 1 Chronicles 29:9. The people rejoiced because they had given willingly, for with a whole heart they had offered freely to the Lord. What kind of thinking or what kind of theology produces that kind of joyous giving? Well, it's described really in the words of David, starting in 1 Chronicles 29:11, a verse that I have underlined in my Bible at home. David says, "Thine, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heavens and in the earth is thine. Thine is the kingdom, O Lord, and thou art exalted as head above all." When we have that kind of perspective, that kind of view on things, then we give joyously. Because we see that God is greater than any challenge, greater than any problem, that He is the greatest of all, to the point that we have a direct correlation between our concept of the greatness of God and the joy with which we give. He goes on to a second aspect of that good theology when David explains in verses 12 to 14 and then down in verse 16 that everything, absolutely everything, comes from God. He says, "Both riches and honor come from thee, and thou rulest over all. In thy hand are power and might, and in thy hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. And now we thank thee, our God. We praise thy glorious name." And then in verse 16, "O Lord our God, all this abundance that we have provided for building thee a house for thy holy name comes from thy hand and is all thy own." Let's translate that to today. Suppose you were to tally all your possessions and their worth, a house and car, or cars and clothes and business and pension and savings and all those things together. And then someone were to ask you the question, "Where did you get it?" You might say, "I earned it." And somebody else might say, "I saved it." Or someone might say, "I inherited it." But the person who says, "God gave it to me," it isn't so much a matter of my earning or saving or inheriting. Most important of all is that everything that I have comes from God. That's the person who has the theology that produces the practice of joyous giving. David had it. In verse 15, he speaks about being a stranger and a sojourner. He recognized that part of his theology was the temporary character of life, that we're only here for a short time, and what God calls upon us to do is to participate in His great plan of what He's seeking to accomplish. When that kind of theology is ours, we hold everything with a loose grip. Fourth, in a good theology that generates joyous giving, is a matter that's a little bit more difficult to quickly communicate, and that's the matter of testing of faith. David explains it, saying, "I know, my God, that thou triest the heart." God gives us opportunity for our faith to be tested, but He never does it with a view toward defeat. He always does it with a view toward victory. God, when He allows our faith and our lives to be tested and challenged, He always seeks to grow our faith. Now, the truth of it is that when everything is going super fine, when all we have is good things, we have no opportunity to test our faith in Him. and we have no opportunity to grow spiritually. Only in situations that we cannot handle alone are we forced to fully exercise trust in God. And again, that's true in every area of life. In terms of making a choice, would you choose between health or sickness? Well, most of us would choose health. Would you choose between employment or unemployment? Well, most of us would choose having a job. Would you choose between everything going great or everything going right? Well, you choose everything going great. But if that's the way it was, if God never sent challenges our way, we would never grow spiritually. We would never depend upon Him. Let's imagine, since the focus of what we're talking about relates to buildings and construction, that we had two choices. Choice number one has several divisions, and choice number two has several divisions. In choice number one, we have land available close by. Suppose that tomorrow morning we get a call from the Hennepin County Commissioners, and they say, well, we're having a budget cutback, and so we got to get rid of Augsburg Park, and we'll sell it to you, $1,000. And we'll spread out the payments over 10 years at 4% interest, and if that's out of hand, we're willing to negotiate. In addition to that, we check the bank balance, and the church account has $10 million in cash accumulating 15% interest, and we have to have an emergency meeting of the church because the interest is just accumulating too quickly, and we've got to do something about it. We've got a real problem there and how to handle that. And then we have everybody in the church as happy and satisfied as can be. Nobody's disgruntled about anything. Everybody's going around giggling and bubbling, and I mean, not a criticism or a complaint about anything. And then to top all that off, the economy is just fantastic. I mean, all we have is more and more money, and prices keep dropping on everything. The bottom's just falling out on prices with all this extra money around. That's choice one, okay? Choice number two, unreachable challenges. Not enough money, not enough time, people with doubts, criticism, opposition, predictions of human failure. Choice one, choice two. Well, I'm sure most of us would undoubtedly pick choice number one. But I doubt that if choice number one were a reality, that we would ever grow spiritually. I doubt that God would ever get any credit at all. When there is difficulty, when there is test, when there are problems, when there is simply no human solution to the challenge before us, and when it happens anyway, then at the end of the course, when an assessment is made and someone says, who gets the credit? There is no question at all. God gets it all because it couldn't have been done without Him. I believe that God gives us testings of faith. And when we understand that as part of our theology, that good theology generates joyous giving. It did for David and the people of Israel, and it works today. A fifth aspect of David's good theology generating joyous giving was his understanding of God's faithfulness. He talks about it in verses 18 and 19. He says, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, our fathers, keep forever such purposes and thoughts in the hearts of thy people and direct their hearts toward thee. Grant to Solomon, my son, that with a whole heart he may keep thy commandments, thy testimonies, and thy statutes, performing all, and that he may build the palace for which I have made provision. David wasn't around back in Abraham's time. Of course, he hadn't been born. But he knew the story. He knew the story that Abraham didn't have a land. He didn't have a place to live. He didn't have citizenship or a passport. All he had was a promise from God. And God provided and was faithful. David wasn't around in Isaac's day when his family was torn apart with dissension, antagonism, hostility, even to the point of threats of murder. But David knew that God had been faithful. Nor was David around in Israel's day, known to us also as Jacob. Back in those days, it was a matter of famine, till they thought the whole family of Israel, the chosen people, the promised seed of the Messiah, would be wiped out by hunger. But God was faithful. Now, of course, David had been around in his time. He knew what it was like as a lad to hold a slingshot in his hand and see a lion attacking and find God faithful. He knew what it was like when the whole army of his nation was cowering and ready for defeat before a giant called Goliath, and he stood out there without armor, and God was faithful. He knew what it was like when the kingdom was being torn apart by civil war, and God was faithful. He knew what it meant when the Philistines were conquering cities all around the perimeter and penetrating into the nation, and God was faithful. And now he is praying that Solomon, his son, and the people in the generations to follow will have the same theology of God's faithfulness and trust in him as had been the case with Abraham and with Isaac and Israel and David. That kind of theology, that kind of trust in God and his faithfulness is what generates joyous giving. Because the God of Abraham is our God, as is the God of Isaac and Israel and David and Solomon. God who has been faithful then is God who will be faithful today. The results of it all, the results were that the people rejoiced because they had given willingly, for with a whole heart they had offered freely to the Lord. Now our time is gone and I'm halfway through the three of the six lessons. Not time to really go over them. Perhaps you ought to read the scripture for yourselves. Discover the lesson that buildings are to meet God, not to hold him. God can't be contained in a place, but a place can be used to meet the Lord of heaven. Learn the lesson that the focus in ancient times was on function, not on form. It was a place where they were to pray. It was a place of evangelism. It was a place of enhancing the reputation of the Lord. It was a place where God was to be honored and his people were to be rewarded. And only secondarily was the form of the place that God had chosen. And learn the lesson, maybe the most difficult of all, that today's success precludes not tomorrow's sin. Solomon, with all his wisdom and with all his wealth, Solomon who built the temple, was Solomon who led the nation of Israel into iniquity. A little over 5 years ago, Charlene and I flew to the Twin Cities to visit Wooddale's people. We stayed at the Registry Hotel out by the airport, and that Friday afternoon met in a conference room with members of the calling committee that was seeking a senior pastor for this church. We learned a lot about the church, and the committee members learned a lot about us that afternoon and that evening. And then we were left with a car that we could drive around, become acquainted with the area, and Saturday morning. We got up Saturday morning and first of all drove over here and drove down Nicollet Avenue and First Avenue and around these buildings and around the area. And Charlene and I had a discussion, and I shared with her then something that I don't think I've ever told anyone since. But I recognized clearly what the situation was, that if God's blessing was to continue upon this church, that it was inevitable at some time in the future there would have to be a new building, if not a relocation. And I had a few years before in a previous pastorate gone through a similar situation where the church relocated to another site, sold a building and raised the money and design and all the many, many things that were involved. And I came to a rather firm conclusion that that was not what I wanted, and came to the conclusion that I would far rather enjoy the fruits of that experience than to go through that experience all over again. And so I had made up my mind that Wooddale was not the place for me. And we did have another appointment back here at the building before we were to take our flight back home. And that appointment was with Austin Chapman and Bob Lamsey, who were members of that calling committee. And it was to tour this building. And I'll admit I did it with disinterest. And finally, when we got that over with, because I had in my mind decided what the answer was, we met for a few minutes out here in the lounge area and sat down on the couch about where that building model is on display this morning. And Bob Lamsey, I think, sensed a little bit of what had been going on in my heart and mind. And really, without any buildup in the conversation, he said, "Pastor, you know, I'm sorry that what you've seen today is the building, because the building really isn't very important at all. In fact, the building hardly matters. I wish you could meet the people. Because the people is what makes this church great. It's the people who love God, the people who seek to make disciples, the people who seek to share their faith, and the people who seek to grow spiritually, and the people who seek to walk with him. And the building, well, it's only the place where we gather together so that those far more important things can happen. In a sense, it was a word of rebuke, a word that I really believe was a word through Bob Lamsey's lips that were words from God himself, a lesson that I needed to learn, a lesson that least important of all is the form and most important of all is the function, that God calls upon us to build buildings only so that there and through those circumstances we can learn his lessons, we can know him, we can share his fellowship, and we can make disciples. My dear friends of Wooddale, I believe that God is giving to us a unique and unprecedented challenge, an opportunity to trust him for doing that which we cannot humanly do ourselves, an opportunity for the stretching of faith and the learning of lessons, an opportunity for the repeat in our time of great things which he did in ancient times, an opportunity for us, like the people of Israel long ago, to raise up in answer to a challenge that God has not only given, but that God will make come true. And the result of it all will be glory to his name. And by his grace, may we learn the lessons and take his challenge. Will you stand with me to pray? Father, there are so many, many lessons for us to learn. In some ways, it seems as if we are school children all seated at our desks. And there you stand at the chalkboard. Each day, new lessons. Each day, new facts. Each day, new experiences. But Lord, we find in them a delight and a joy that you take your time in the midst of the busyness of the universe to instruct us in your ways and to be together with us. Lord, by your grace, we will learn your lessons, and most of all, we will seek to follow your direction. Lord, by your grace, we will trust you to be faithful in our generation, as you have been faithful in generations gone by. And Lord, by your grace, we will place the emphasis upon knowing you and serving you, and not the form in which it happens. Lord, by your grace, we will be your people and do that which you lead us to, for the glory of your Son.